Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never change anything.
Ah! Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Here's Harrison again. Harrison, brilliant intellectual, race and class conscious, radical internationalist. He defines himself as a radical internationalist. A. Philip Randolph and others refer to him as the father of Harlem radicalism in a period when Harlem is considered the center of radical black thought and the international Negro Mecca. This is what people are saying about Harlem in this period. And I argue he is a key ideologue because he is class radical and race radical. He is a key ideological link in the unity of the civil rights and black liberation movement, civil rights slash black liberation movement. The Martin and Malcolm strands, right? They kind of come together in Harrison. We'll get into this. Joel A. Rogers, world's great men of color. Joel A. Rogers, and he knew Harrison extremely well. In World's Great Men of Color, Joel A. Rogers describes Hubert Harrison as the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era. That's extraordinarily high praise. It's amidst chapters on Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, William Monroe Trotter, and Marcus Garvey. So extremely high praise. And he goes on to say, and the leader with the sanest program. So first I'm going to talk about Harrison as an intellectual. Then I'm going to talk about Harrison as a radical. Again, these are just opening remarks. I want to get into this in great depth. When Harrison comes to New York in 1900, and we'll get into his Caribbean background next week, he, like so many immigrants, he comes, he's working 5 days a week, a couple of nights, he's an orphan, he's got to make ends meet. He goes to high school because he's got this desire to learn. He goes to high school at night, and the New York World, one of the dailies in New York, runs a headline because he wins these awards. He wins citywide honors in New York City. Genius found in West Indian students. They'd never seen anyone like this, right? Latin honors. He's barely going to school. All right. He spoke or read six languages, and I know this in part from his diary, and because in his papers, by the way, was his diary, which when I said the family gave me all his papers in 1981, 82, they gave me all except one thing. The daughter held it for a while. And that was after I finished a dissertation on Harrison, and I took her out to dinner, and we were sitting down and talking, and she goes, oh, I have one more thing for you, and she gave me his diary, which he had kept since he started it in 1907, this version. So, and it was a total gold mine. So that's when I knew I had two volumes worth of work. It's major, major document. So he read or spoke six languages, including Arabic, and not because he was religious, but because it was a religion of so many people of African descent, right? He was reading, in his last year, he was reading the Quran, to be familiar with this, right? He read voraciously. When he dies, the obituary, several of the obituaries, one or two of them commented that it was reported he read several books a day. And you might say, oh, gee, that's, they're just pumping that. But I went through his books. And I also, in my youth, took a speed reading course. He knew how to attack a book. You see his books, and you could see where he honed in. He focused on what sections, what he wanted to deal with. He'd mark it up. He'd interact with it. So I certainly believe it. And his clippings were voluminous and in all kinds of areas, right? So he did read voraciously. And when Rogers talks about the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era, Rogers is not speaking loosely. Rogers writes two volumes on world's great men of color, right? He knows who these players are, who these figures are and what they did. As an orator, Hubert Harrison was a pioneering soapbox orator. He would speak on the street corners. He'd speak indoors also, Cooper Union, places like that, you know, I mean, all over, public libraries, a big, big proponent of free public libraries. But I want to focus on his oratory outdoors right now. History, science, politics, religion, education, literature, theater, evolution, race and class. As a soapbox orator, I just wanted to highlight a couple things to drive this home. He spoke as many as 23 times a week. That's morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week, for the Socialist Party in 1912. That's when Eugene Debs is running for president and Harrison is the leading black activist in the party. This next one for the occupiers, right? People in the Occupy movement. New York Times, September 13th, refers to September 13th, 1912. It's actually the paper of the 14th. Hubert Harrison, an eloquent and forceful Negro speaker, shattered all records for distance in an address on socialism in front of the stock exchange. His voice carried the furthermost limits of the crowd. He was still going strong at the beginning of the third hour, and he continued on until the big bell closed the exchange. That was an early Occupy movement, right? But unfortunately, the occupiers today are not aware of that history, and I think it would be important, you know, to bring much, much more into that movement, right? He spoke before 50,000 people at Union Square. He spoke all over the city. I'm going to give you a quote from Henry Miller on Harrison when he saw Harrison as a youth at Madison Square, unrivaled, his quantum idol, he refers to him as. And in Harlem, it is Hubert Harrison who pioneers tradition of soapbox oratory that is subsequently picked up by A. Philip Randolph, Chandler Owen, Richard B. Moore, Marcus Garvey, and later Malcolm X. 134th Street and Lenox Avenue, and we have here Marlowe, Issa, Sean, some people who were in, we got petitions outside the Schomburg Center to rename what it was called back then, what it was referred to back then, 134th and Lenox, as Liberty Corner, and to get it renamed Hubert Harrison Way, and it passed unanimously at Community Board 10. And then all of a sudden the bureaucracy stepped in, and a moratorium, and nothing's been done on it, right? So we have to revisit that issue. But that I mean, it should be named for Hubert Harrison, and all the proper procedures were followed, right? Here's Henry Miller, again, as I said, and if people don't know Henry Miller, very important, a semi-autobiographical novelist, my youth, Fred's youth, but he's also a socialist in his youth, right? And here's what he writes. We won't go through all of this, but this is on Harrison. There was no one in those days who could hold a candle to Hubert Harrison. And invariably, you'd hear this. Harrison was unrivaled orator. With a few well-directed words, he had the ability to demolish any opponent. He smiled, his easy assurance, great sculptured head, which he carried on his shoulders. He was a man who electrified one by his mere presence. He always retained his self-possession, his dignity. He had a way of placing the back of his hand on his hip, his trunk tilted, his ears cocked to catch every last word of the questioner or heckler. He would bide his time. When the tumult had subsided, there would come that broad smile, a broad, good-natured grin. He would answer his man, always fair and square, always full on like a broadside. Soon everyone would be laughing. So he really could work the crowd. He brilliant lecturer. Spoke not from notes so much. I mean, he's just remarkable, right? Remarkable. And there are so many accounts in that biography, I quote, from contemporaries on Harrison's oratorical abilities, on his intellect. You will be just utterly shocked to read about this and ask again. You'll constantly be asking, why didn't we know about this before? All right. Still on Harrison is a brilliant intellectual. 700 pieces, I mentioned, I'm going to try and get them all up online. As an editor, as a journalist, as an editor, he was editor, not the principal editor, but an editor of The Masses, which is the leading left literary publication of that decade between 1910 and 20. Follow. He was the editor of The Voice, subtitled A Newspaper for the New Negro, 1917 and 19, the first paper of the New Negro Movement. 1917, you read the canon, the canonical literature, New Negro, Alain Locke, 1925. That's what we've been fed. Harrison founds this New Negro Movement 8 years earlier in militant political and social activism, but it's extraordinarily literary. Still, if you're still leaning with that 1925 date, try this. Harrison edits The New Negro, titled New Negro, 1919, an organ of the international consciousness of the darker races, especially the Negro race. It's a monthly publication. The Voice was a weekly. In 1920, he becomes the principal editor of the Negro World, that's Garvey's newspaper, and he reshapes it, and the paper sweeps the globe under his editorship. In the book, A Hubert Harrison Reader, you have some of Harrison's comments on what he did to reshape that publication editorially. And I encourage people to look at that stuff. And in volume two, I will be getting into that in great depth. And his final publication was The Voice of the Negro in 1927. That's publication of his last organizational effort, the International Colored Unity League. And again, we see some parallel with Malcolm later on. For those familiar with Malcolm's life, his last effort is the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the more broadly unitary part. As a critic, Hubert Harrison, he starts writing when he's in high school. This guy's writing letters, getting published in the New York Times in 1903. He's in high school. In 1907, he has two articles published on book reviewing on the front page of the New York Times Saturday Review of Books. That's when they did the review of books back then. Now it's the Sunday Review of Books. Eugene O'Neill wins the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1936 after Harrison does a review of The Emperor Jones. O'Neill writes to Harrison, says, this is as fine as a piece as I've seen. Any theater I have anything to do with, you have a role in, right? You know, high praise, right?
Harriet Tubman began her life in the bonds of slavery, but lived her life helping others achieve their freedom.
She really helped black people have a sense of self, a sense of freedom, and a sense that, you know, slavery was not right.
Araminta Harriet Ross was born into slavery around 1820 in Dorchester County, Maryland. As a child, she was loaned out to different plantations. By the time she turned 12, she was working in the fields. When she was a young teen, she suffered a severe injury which would affect her for the rest of her life.
A slave owner threw a metal weight at another slave and accidentally hit her in the head. For the rest of her life, she suffered epilepsy, terrible headaches, but she also had these strange visions, which she ascribed to God communicating to her. And she took these visions as a symbol of her mission, like Moses, to go and free her people.
In 1844, she married John Tubman, who was a free black man, a fairly common occurrence in Maryland. Harriet was determined to escape her life of slavery, and in 1849, she finally did it. She risked her life by making her way from Maryland to Philadelphia. She followed the North Star and used the so-called Underground Railroad to make it to freedom.
Lord, I'm a pilgrim.
The Underground Railroad was an organized group of free blacks, whites, and Christian abolitionists who helped slaves escape to the North. Harriet had made it to the Promised Land. No one would have blamed her if she never returned to the South, but she desperately wanted to free her family. She made perilous trips back to free her two brothers, her sister, and her sister's two children. When she made a third trip to get her husband, she found he had taken another wife. Instead of returning with her husband, she saved more slaves.
Not only did she escape slavery and achieve freedom for herself, but she went back down into the South to bring freedom to dozens of other slaves.
Harriet was clever as she was brave, figuring out countless tricks to bring many slaves to freedom over the next several years.
The fact that she developed these paths and trails that took people through the country, and they traveled at night and they used quilts to have secret codes and know the paths, and then to bring people north across the Mason-Dixon line into Ohio to find freedom. So she was a pioneer and I think a very, very strong woman.
Her legendary status as an Underground Railroad conductor earned her the nickname Moses.
Well, I think Harriet Tubman's name Moses, you know, comes from Moses from the Bible, leading people to freedom. And it's a very, very proper name, I think, for her, and one that she definitely lived up to.
In 1850, things became more dangerous for Harriet when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. Instead of being a free woman, she was now a fugitive. She continued to free slaves, but now guiding them to Canada so they could truly be free. From 1851 to 1857, Harriet lived mostly north of the border in St. Catharines, Canada. She continued to make trips to Maryland twice a year to save more slaves. Besides her work as a liberator of slaves, Harriet spoke in support of anti-slavery and women's rights. Her efforts made her a wanted woman with a bounty on her head, but she was never turned in. She aided abolitionist John Brown with his plans for the raid on Harper's Ferry. During the Civil War, the government asked her to help the Union cause by organizing a network of spies among black men in the South.
Not only was she known as the Great Liberator, but she also assisted the Union Army, going down on patrols and advising Union officers on how best to attack the South.
Out in the trenches, she also helped Colonel James Montgomery disrupt Southern supply lines, which resulted in the freedom of hundreds of slaves. After the war, Harriet dedicated herself to establishing schools for freed men in South Carolina. Even though she couldn't read or write, she understood the value of education. In her later years, Tubman worked with her friend, Susan B. Anthony, to support the cause of women's suffrage.
Harriet Tubman is relevant today, not only for her work in terms of racial justice, but also in terms of women's rights. After the Civil War, she became an outspoken supporter for the suffrage movement to get women the right to vote.
To help make ends meet and continue to help the causes she believed in, she worked on a book called Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman. In 1908, she established a home for older poor African Americans in Auburn, New York, which she moved into in 1911. She lived there till her death in 1913 from pneumonia. She was buried with full military honors.
I was young, but I remember.
Harriet Tubman, you know, has a lot of significance for black people, particularly in the age of Obama, because she kind of started the liberation of black people, you know, in the days of slavery, and really set the path of civil rights in the United States.
Harriet Tubman's bravery and determination allowed her to accomplish incredible things throughout her amazing life.
From Galilee.
She is someone that you cannot forget. She is someone that really kind of changed our perception of what equality and freedom and liberation and civil rights mean.
The hour I first believed.
But I do want to add this. Probably the greatest black revolutionary socialist in the early part of the 20th century was a brother named Herbert Harrison.
Yep.
He was the founder of Local 5, Socialist Party. He was the most popular lecturer in the city of New York and was very close to Ingersoll as well as Clarence Darrow. And it was reading Thomas Paine that turned him into not simply a revolutionary, but also an agnostic. Now, Paine was not an agnostic, he was a deist. But when Hubert Harrison, he was a genius, a Caribbean genius, came off the boat, came straight to Harlem, lived on 134th Street. And when he died, there was just 7 folk there, and it's an unmarked grave to this day. Read Jeffrey Perry's magnificent magisterial biography, and that's just volume one.
Yep. Volume one, volume two.
Hubert Harrison, historical amnesia. Everybody knows about Booker T. Washington. God bless the Negro. He founded the black institution. I'm for founding black institution. Own white money, own white elite money, against the unions, against our precious immigrants coming in, deeply pro-capitalist. Everybody knows Booker T. Washington. What about Hubert Harrison in the legacy of Tom Paine across race? We could.
Brooklyn Independent Television.
It's been nearly 2 months since the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission greenlit the Group Vehicle Ride Pilot Program. The program was designed to help commuters along corridors where bus routes had been eliminated. The B-71 is the latest route to join the program, and Sherry Carabin jumped aboard the dollar van to find out if it's smooth sailing.
Our starting point is that Franklin, that's the starting point, and Eastern Parkway.
The B-71 service area is among a handful that are part of the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission's Group Ride Vehicle Pilot Project. The vans cost $2 a ride and are designed to assist those living in areas where the MTA has discontinued bus routes. The first group ride vehicles hit the streets around mid-September in Queens. Brooklyn's B-23 and B-39 routes are also part of the pilot. The B-71 route starts in Crown Heights and ends in Red Hook, with Brooklyn Van Lines providing the service.
traditionally van companies would operate in Caribbean neighborhoods, Caribbean American neighborhoods, Central Brooklyn, and in Queens. But this new agreement with the city expanded our range in going to into areas that we would normally would not go. So that is a given. That is a good thing. I think it's a good thing for the van industry.
Right now, Brooklyn Van Lines has about a half dozen drivers, manning the van 7 days a week from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. On this Sunday, I decided to get on board and take a tour of the route myself. It's the latest area of the borough to be serviced by group ride vehicles, but those who operate the former B-71 bus route are having a hard time getting commuters to hop on board.
The numbers are in 15 to 20 range for the day, which
15 to 20 passengers for the entire day?
Right. So,
with numbers like those, it's hard to make ends meet.
For insurance costs, almost $10,000 per year. You got to do DOT inspection 2 times per year. There's a diamond there, you got to pay a TLC diamond. It's $550 for 2 years. Registration fee also went up.
3 months ago, the MTA cut that route, and it took really too long. This should have been done the following day after the last bus left that route. But it took so long before the city could make this agreement and make this arrangement with the van companies that all of the riders pretty much went back to, you know, taking their own transportation or finding some other form of transporting themselves to their work and their shopping areas.
TLC Commissioner David Yaski admits there are growing pains, saying, quote, "The challenge is to make sure that as many people as possible are aware of the service. And to that end, we've been assisting to the extent that we can by devoting space on our website to the services, printing and distributing thousands of flyers and palm cards, making presentations at community forums, and enlisting the media to help spread the word. But we do hope to see the operators become far more aggressive in their marketing and outreach efforts," end quote. Certainly, some of the residents Brooklyn Review spoke to seem to be unaware of the service, but not unwilling to consider using it.
So would you be likely to use them now that you know about them?
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? I would give it a shot.
I really don't know much about it, but if it can get me where I need to go, yeah, I would take it.
This Community Board 6 member has a different take on the issue.
Well, ideally, I'd like to see the bus service return. Failing that, it would be nice if the vans were on some kind of predictable schedule.
Setting a schedule is one of the things those at Brooklyn Van Lines are looking at, but it's not their only focus.
Some of the things we're considering includes, you know, $1 fare during off-peak and weekend times, or some sort of all-you-can-ride for a period of time. Fares, you know, maybe $3, you can ride for 3 hours. Or something to get people to try the service for some of their daily needs.
In the coming weeks, those who run Brooklyn Van Lines say they'll be hitting the streets and distributing flyers to residents and local businesses, letting everyone know these groups.
Okay, today's It's My House is titled Harriet Tubman, Squirrel Logic, and the versus the coronavirus. Harriet Tubman, Squirrel Logic versus the coronavirus. We played a couple of audio clips. The last one talking about, what's the van service in New York City have to do with anything? Well, let me bring out some statistics to attempt to paint a story. New York State has a population of 19.2 million people. That's the entire state, including New York City. Once again, 19 million people. New York City, New York City proper has a population of 8.3 million people. That's like 40% of the entire population of New York State is in New York City. And, of course, that city is broken down into five boroughs, Manhattan, Brooks, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, each of which, all of them have a million-plus people, but the five of them together are known as New York City. Manhattan, which is also known as New York, New York, Manhattan, which is an island. Matter of fact, let's get the stats on that. Population of Manhattan. Population of Manhattan, New York is 1,629,000. That's nearly 2 million people. But let's keep it at the numbers, 1,629,000 on an island that's only 3 miles wide and 12 miles long. That's it. So when you've got, and that's why, you know, the Governor Cuomo, when New York State isn't really in a crisis mode. It's New York City that's in the crisis mode. Because you got a lot of density. Like I said, you got 40% of the entire state's population in one city. Well, let's break it down into five cities to be fair about it, to be accurate about it. Like I say, New York City is made of five boroughs: Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, Staten Island. That's a lot of density. Now, the reason why I put Harriet Tubman and also put squirrel logic in there, because let's start with the squirrel logic. If you take, and the squirrels represent nature. In nature, you don't have the, in the animal kingdom, in the insect kingdom, there's not density. Like it is in a human being kingdom. It goes against the law. We're not supposed to be living that close to each other. And if you take a look at nature, like if you got a dog. Dogs are very territorial. Matter of fact, many animals are very territorial, but let's take a dog that lives in the city. The one I have, now we're on a little bit over a quarter acre. So when we go in the front yard, anybody that dog sees, like a quarter acre, actually, probably about a half acre, within a half acre radius of the front lawn, this dog considers that her territory. And unless she knows you, you don't come on that territory. You don't even step onto that territory, because then she'll go run and chase you off. Animals and humans alike. Now, there's enough land on this planet where each and every individual can have like 2.3 acres of land. That's a little bit over 8 football fields. But in any event, like I said, getting back to New York, so, you know, Governor Cuomo, he's on air daily, if not twice a day, giving an update. But the majority of problems that are happening in any populated area concerning this coronavirus is essentially in highly populated areas that have a lot of density. And like I say, the state of New York, 40% of the entire state population is in New York City. That's a whole lot of people in one place, like, say, Manhattan Island, only 3 miles wide. 12 miles long, but it has over 1.6 million people in that small amount of space. For those who are familiar with the concept of carbon footprint, that they got a high carbon footprint in Manhattan, New York. Now, here's where the Harriet Tubman comes part in. With the squirrel logic and the coronavirus. Harriet Tubman, in our world of 2020, would be considered illiterate. She couldn't read or write. However, she was literate, very literate, when it comes to survival skills in nature. She never got caught or anything like that. And when she was on these slave rescue missions, or whatever you want to call them, with the Underground Railroad, you know, they were safe houses, but, you know, sometimes they may have to go a day or two. You don't know how many days they might have to go in between getting from one safe house to the next safe house. So what did they do for food? They had to travel light. So what were some of the life skills? What was her survival literacy when it comes to nature? In other words, what kind of foods, berries, nuts, what have you, trees, plants, what were available? I mean, she recognized that. What to eat, what not to eat, what plants were good for medicine. Okay, hygiene, keeping yourself hygienic, and, you know, with this Underground Railroad thing. Camping. I'm sure she knew how to make it, because sometimes it was rain, so, or snow. So what kind of a shelter could she put together and teach other people how to do it, you know, when inclement weather came about? And it did come about. I wish they would talk more about this during, we would call it camping today. So, that's what I put Harriet Tubman, squirrel logic, those two, knowing or getting yourself literate or getting yourself educated. Because basically the people that have survival skills in 2020, as did Harriet Tubman, they didn't experience any type of crisis like this. The only people that are really experiencing this so-called crisis are the people who don't have the skill set or haven't prepared for times such as these. There are preppers out here, and you can go on YouTube, there are preppers out here that know how to go to the store. They got everything they need right at home. And this goes back to squirrel logic. All right. It's springtime right now. March, almost April. If you look at the squirrel is, you know, doing his daily living, you know, gathering their nuts or whatever they need, but they're storing part of what they gather away for the wintertime. They're storing now, spring, summer, fall, and then they pack it in. Me personally, I think this should be taught in school, at least taught at home. How to prepare for your seasons yearly, and then what if there's some type of, like I said, it's only a crisis when you haven't prepared for something. If you haven't prepared for something, then you're in crisis mode. So in my opinion, that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing basically at your newscasters that's bringing you the news, the mainstream news in particular, the politicians, the governors, all these people basically know their survival literacy skills are zero or near zero. They're depending on outside sources, such as the government, to rescue them. And the government can't rescue everybody. Politicians talk that way. But there's never been a government that's been invented by man that can solve all the needs to all the people all the time. Although some people look at it that way, but it doesn't exist. Thus, today's podcast, Harriet Tubman, who was highly literate when it came to common, everyday survival skills. And she had a house. She didn't have to do those underground missions, Underground Railroad missions. She had a house with about 20, 25 acres or so. She didn't even do it. However, when she did it, though, she had the skill sets when it comes to camping. And I'm not talking about Boy Scout camping. I'm talking about, like I say, in the raw, because nature's basically a grocery store. But she had to be familiar with the landscape, you know, what plants to eat, what not to eat, like, say, medicine, everything's out there. But modern-day education, well, put it this way, state-sponsored education and a lot of private school education does not teach that type of thing. Fortunately, we do have YouTube and people online that can teach you some of these survival skills or whatever. But the main thing with a crisis, I mean, you know what, if we don't do it tomorrow or this week, we'll do it next week. Crisis literacy. And the big thing with crisis literacy is be prepared. Some people that they have called hoarders are now seen as people that were prepared. They don't have to go shopping for squat. You got everything. But we haven't it's not a hit the fan, in my opinion, it's not the hit the fan crisis this far or whatever. But like I say, put it this way, people that live in the rural parts of New York State, have a different level of comfort. Now, it might not be a Whole Foods in that particular county, but that's okay. They're good with what they have, and they're basically self-sufficient. So it all, there's a community up, it's right on the tip of my tongue. Ithaca, New York. Let me see what I can pull up on that. Let's see, Ithaca, New York. There is a a time banking community there. Where they have their own community currency. Oh, man, let's see. Ithaca, New York. Let me try to find it for you. Time Bank. See if I can get you a video on it. But anyway, let's go to 410. 410, your mic is open.
Hi, Brother Elliot. It's been a while since I've had a chance to speak with you. How you doing?
Fine, fine. Good to hear your voice.
Since I'm in quarantine, I got a chance to listen to you today.
Well, thank God for the quarantine.
Yeah. Look. I'm getting stir crazy in here, so some of the things I'm about to say might be very controversial. But I want to lend to your conversation if I can.
Sure. Oh, you know what? Add on those five necessities that is imperative that people need to be aware of, particularly if they're starting a business or, their personal lives.
What, the food, clothing, shelter? Transportation.
Right, that exactly. That's
and
right.
Healthcare. You know what, Brother L.A., I was thinking about something that you're discussing right now, and I talked to a preacher about it about two or three Sundays ago. It's now to the point that we're almost in crisis mode. And I was telling him that, you know what, there's a parable in the Bible about the five wise maidens and the five foolish maidens. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. But the five wise, huh?
Yeah, I am. I heard it, but refresh me though. I haven't read it in a while.
Well, what happened, they were waiting for the prince to come. And they were waiting for him to show up, and the five wise maidens bought their lamps and they bought some extra oil with them. And the five foolish maidens just bought the lamps with oil in them. So what happened, the prince came late. And the thing is, the foolish maidens ran out of oil and the lamps went out because it was dark. And the five wise maidens had enough oil to keep their lamps burning. So when the prince did show up, the five foolish maidens had to go back and get oil. And when they got back, they couldn't get into the party. And they asked the five wise maidens, hey, look, you got some extra oil, give us some. And the five wise maidens said, hey, I just got enough for myself. So I can't give you any. So five foolish maidens had to go back and get oil. And by the time they got back, they were excluded from the gathering with the prince. And the five wise maidens was in there with the prince having a good time. And I said that to say this. We black folks are in a mess because there's a famous phrase you always use, and I'm going to repeat it. I know you get tired of me bringing it back to your memory.
Identity.
But, you know, all of these, huh?
Identity.
That's part of it. But the other thing that you always stress, and I've used that in some of my presentations, is we have operated as a lone wolf for so many years.
Right.
Until now that we need to be in a wolf pack to survive. We're not able to do that because, like you said before, that identity thing, we haven't stressed it enough to where we can go in and respond to these types of emergencies. And I give you an example. In D.C. where you were, and in Baltimore where I am, and in New York, because, you know, I go there quite often,
mm-hmm.
there's a church on every corner.
You're
and
right.
The thing is, like they're all within, I mean, every block has a black church in it. And the thing is, with everybody being on quarantine, in quarantine, or either being secluded and they can't get out, if they were a wolf pack, they could have already had enough supplies to go in and feed their members or people in that community and to survive that crisis. And the thing is, we are very unprepared because, look, all these other ethnic groups, they have stores on every corner and they have distribution centers for their stores. So they are too much worried about what's going to happen. And look, if black folks go there and try and ask them for something, the first thing they're going to say is like the five wise maidens and say, well, look, I just got enough of my people. I'd like to help you, but hey, look, self-preservation's got to kick in here. And that's the thing that you was talking about with your dog. You know, self-preservation is a key to survival of the species. And the other thing is what? Survival of the fittest. And that's what it's coming down to now. And with that thing with Harriet Tubman, see, Harriet, we always stress a single individual. But see, Harriet Tubman had an infrastructure in place. In fact, Underground Railroad was the most ingenious creation that black folks have ever created or any other ethnic racial group.
I agree.
She didn't have to worry about getting to certain points in that Underground Railroad. Even if she was a long distance away from the next station, there were people that would drop off certain dry goods or certain things that they needed in certain spots, whether they were there or not. All she had to do was get to a spot, and she knew that there would be enough food and water, whatever what they needed, to that spot, even though there wasn't a station there. And they'd go and supply that little spot there ever so often to make sure that, hey, look, those slaves in between those stations, if they needed something, they could always get it. And that's something that we don't realize when we studied Underground Railroad, because we have an Underground Railroad museum here. And they go through how that Underground Railroad was organized. And the thing is, just because there were miles between those stations didn't mean that Harriet Tubman couldn't get enough food to make it to the next point, even though that station may have been miles and miles apart. Somebody would always go and put something in place so that if they needed something, they could get it, and it was a hidden spot in the woods, or they had a certain marker on a tree or something where they knew that if they hit that spot, they could get food if they ran out of it, or water, or what have you. But I want to get back to where we are. I asked that preacher.
That's good information. That's very good information. You're right. She had an infrastructure in place.
Yeah, no doubt. And the thing is, Harriet Tubman didn't operate as a lone wolf.
Nope.
It was a wolf pack creation. And that's something that we've gotten away from, because I asked that preacher. I said, look, have you gotten with your trustees and you got with other ministers and other denominations to make sure that our church kitchen could go in and supply meals to the elderly and to ever who needed it And I say, look, I will be willing to give you a good-sized donation for you to stockpile enough food and dry goods. Because, look, a pound of Great Northern beans will feed a great number of people. I don't know if you're familiar with Great Northern beans, dry beans, pinto beans.
I am familiar with them. My grandmother used to cook them all the time.
Well, you can take a pot of beans and you can feed a whole lot of people. And I was telling him, you know, why don't we go in and stockpile these things? It won't be a first-class meal, but in a time like this, it'll be enough for you to survive. And get these smoked meats and go in and stockpile them and get the other churches in the communities to stockpile them and put your money together instead of putting it in the bank. Go in and let's go ahead on and make sure that these churches in these communities can go in once the lockdown comes. People can either walk to the church or either you can have the trustees and the deacons deliver these plates to the different families in the neighborhood. Because I'm telling you now, Brother L.A., if it comes to people feeding their group and feeding black folk, they're going to feed their group first. And if, depending on how long this thing lasts, they might not have enough to share. Even if they have a good heart, they may not have enough to share.
No, that's interesting because lately, I was ordering Chinese delivery to my house here. And for the last week, they don't even pick up the phone.
That's right. That's right.
I know they're not starving because it's a little family.
No, they ain't starving. That's right.
But they ain't making delivery.
So you see the handwriting on the wall. All they got in stock now is for them to survive this crisis.
Right.
Money's not important now. Survival
right.
is important. Money
right.
can't do you any good if you're on lockdown.
That's
and
true.
They're saying to you, look, we got some food, but we ain't going out in business until this thing is over.
Right.
So
you're right. I mean, you know, I done called them like every other day, and because I've been ordering from them for years. Ain't nothing but like a mile and a half, 2 miles away from my front door.
Uh-huh.
And I know they got food. But they ain't picking up that phone to make deliveries. That's all I know.
And look, you know what they're going to do with that food too, don't you?
Yeah, that's their food.
Well, that's right. That's what they're going to survive off of. You know.
Right.
But I just thought I'd throw that out there, Brother L.A., because, you know, sometimes you said that Harriet Tubman didn't have education. Well, a lot of ex-slaves didn't have education.
Well,
but
now,
they had.
Now, let me put that in context. Like I said, that's what we would say. I consider her a literate person. Forget about the reading and
yeah.
writing. She knew how to survive out in the wilderness. She got skills I would like to learn personally.
Yeah.
I consider her literate when it comes. I consider literacy, if you're good, like I say, if she knew how to survive out there because she knew, I mean, you had people with babies, different personalities. She had to be a bit of a social worker in her mindset. So she was literate in a whole lot of things in order to be successful and never get caught because she did have her own house on 20, 25 acres. She didn't need to get out there, but she did.
That's right. That's right. And look, there's different levels of education. You know,
right.
reading and writing is just what it says, reading and writing. But
right.
you know what? You can communicate without reading and writing, and you can learn skills without going to a classroom and not knowing how to read and write. Just because you don't know how to read and write don't mean you're illiterate. It just
right.
means that you're not able to communicate in that type of setting, you know, writing something down or what have you, reading it. But that's where we get confused at, Brother L.A. We don't give slaves enough credit for surviving.
We don't.
Even if you're on a plantation, you had to know how to survive because they weren't
slaves had skill sets to build roads, build houses, build mansions, grow food, run the plantation, all those available literate skill sets and whatnot. And it what's interesting, I asked a friend of mine, she's got a master's degree in education. But if you ask her, how can you grow a tomato? She said she didn't have any seeds. So she don't even, if you go look at a tomato, provided it's not a GMO, you got the seeds in the tomatoes.
That's right. That's right.
But she didn't learn that while she was getting that master's degree.
No, no. And look, that wasn't communicated to her growing up in the communities that we're raised in anymore. And let me give you a personal experience. I'm from the country, and I love collard greens, and I love okra, and I love, you know, tomatoes and all of that stuff, peppers and all of that stuff. So what happened is cabbage and, you know, you name it. So what in green beans? Now, what I did, Brother Ellie, I went to the hardware store, and I created an elevated garden. I went ahead on and got my boards and got my tuba fools, got the plastic wrap and everything. And what happened is I was able to go grow collard greens all year round, cabbage all year round, and I was able to grow okra. Look, I don't know if you're familiar with okra or not. All you have to do is
My mother used to make it for me.
Well, here's the thing. If you put up plant four or five or six hills of okra, that one plant will keep producing until wintertime hits it. You can't pull enough okra off that stalk to keep up with what it's going to produce. The same thing with a tomato. If you put it in an area where it can get light, and you can keep it from the weather. One plant of tomatoes will yield I don't know how many tomatoes for how long. And what I used to do is I used to have fresh vegetables right in the inner city of Baltimore. All I had to do, whenever that cabbage head came up, I'd go ahead on and cut that cabbage head, and I ate cabbage sprouts because it would sprout as long as I kept it water and kept it put nutrients to it. And cabbage sprouts is just as good as the cabbage. But the thing, what I'm trying to tell you is we don't teach each other, and we don't have these programs in these cities for people to learn how to survive. And that's the education that is missing out there. But I'm telling you now, Brother L.A., because we've been lone wolves for so long and we lack the identity, we haven't been able to form ourselves in the wolf packs to take advantage of the resources that we have to survive. And I get
all
of
this. Let me ask you this. Now, I'm looking at this downtime will have an effect on people. Now, what percentage, I don't know. But I think it's going to change the way some people think and live. So going back to the church, which is a good people resource, what do you think can happen from here on out?
Knowing black folk and knowing how we've been conditioned, we'll look right over it. And look, let me tell you this now. Do you remember a hurricane coming on the East Coast called Irene?
I don't remember that one.
Okay. I think it was in 2010 or 2011.
I remember Katrina. Oh, you talking about that came up the North Carolina coast?
Right, exactly.
Okay, I remember that.
Okay, here's what happened. We went weeks without electricity. I mean, it had destroyed everything. No stores was open because the electricity was out. They had to get rid of all of their meats and everything else. The Red Cross came in here, and we had to go in and get in line. Well, I didn't, but people was in line because most of them was in totally electric houses and everything else. Didn't have no telephone service, no nothing. And the thing is, Brother L.A., the nearest place where people could get a hot meal from where I live was 6 miles in any direction. So now, you would have thought that, and look, I brought this up to the same people. I said, you know what? This thing has taught us that we need to turn our churches into feeding centers when emergencies like this hit. Because the churches right. had the kitchen. And they had some of them had the food. And all they, in fact, some people sought shelter in these churches. All they had to do was go in and based on what that experience was with Irene, and say, you know what, we don't need to go into this anymore. Because now, when the Red Cross set up, guess where they set up at? They set up in the white areas, a long ways from where black people were. But now here, you know, most of the time people are intermingled. But they set up in white areas, which meant black folk had to get to where they were serving, and some white folk. But now, guess what? The gas pumps wasn't operating either. So if you didn't have, if you hadn't stockpiled gas in your car, you were just S out of luck. And the thing is, our people saw this. We talked about how bad it was. And I swear to God, we're right here in this crisis again, and nobody took up and said, look, we need to make sure if this ever happened again, that these churches can operate as feeding centers in case somebody can't get to where then they can get to get a hot meal.
You know what? That's an excellent idea because you can set up. They got all these. They got a prison ministry, a sick and shut-in ministry, but a preparation ministry where, like you said, they got dry goods set aside. They got people trained. even you put out something like gas. You know, gas have their own gas pump. That's only used for, a crisis situation. That's an excellent idea. Like you said, many a church, even a lot of these storefronts, they have kitchens.
Yeah.
But they're not being put to use in a time like this.
And these churches could get together in these communities and put up community centers. But all I'm telling you, Brother L.A., is go back to where you started at. I always stress identity and those five keys, you know, food, clothing, shelter, transportation, health care. What was the other? Food, clothing, shelter.
Yeah, food, shelter, transportation, health care, and clothing.
And health care.
Yeah.
See, when you're territorial like an animal, like your dog, see, the first thing they do is they stake out a territory and they make sure that they have a food source in that territory. The other thing is they make sure that they protect it. And they don't need clothing, but they also have shelter in those areas, too, because they can survive any element. But the thing is, because we have formed that identity that says, you know, survival of the fittest and self-preservation, we operate as a lone wolf and not a wolf pack. And the thing is, that's why come we're in a mode here where I hope we can survive, but more than likely, we're going to be the ones to suffer around here. Because everybody's going to go back to being...
You know, a big part of that, Beasley, is some of us, not all of us, too many, and you can throw white folks and some white folks into this too, we look at government as our savior. That there's some kind of program that we can latch on to that will save us, and government cannot save everybody.
It's not set up to save everybody.
Government was never set up to save everybody, although some of these politicians talk that way, but it's not set up that way.
No. And here's the other thing. Even with government programs, with the racism and prejudice of the people that's running those programs, is going to deny black folks from ever really getting being serviced by those programs. And look, I was getting off, but let me give you this. Down here, when you go to the Department of Social Services, I've seen white folk go in, and then the VA, you can ask some black veterans, And look, you can throw in there the black farmers. When the black farmers was trying to get the money to survive, racism set in, and they didn't give those black farmers the loans and the monies that they needed to keep their farms going, and they went out of business because the administrators were bigots. And the same thing with these Department of Social Service programs. Sometimes a black person can go in and you know they need the help, and they'll deny it. Same thing with veterans. So even with government programs to help somebody, racism among the administrators sometimes will deny us the help that we need, which brings me to this point. That's why us being self-reliant is so important in teaching and stressing that. Because we know nobody's out here to help the black person. And I don't care how good a heart they have, some of that racism is going to kick in. And I know I'm going to get some pushback on it, but I'm just telling you what I've experienced. A Mexican can walk across the Rio Grande right now and get more help than a black person that's been here for 400 and some years. And I've seen it. Whenever I go into a DSS office, ain't nothing in there but white folks and Hispanics in this area. So now, even with government being as inefficient as it is and the programs being available, and you can throw in there the Small Business Administration, there's a whole lot of black businesses that needed loans that didn't get them because of racism. So even with government programs and relying on it, we can't rely on that. That's the last thing black folks should rely on is government assistance.
I agree, but some people that are at their social services office, for some people, it's a religion for them. The way I see it, but you're right. We that's the last. Because you got now what they passed this $2 trillion stimulus thing, where I guess you got some people counting their money before they get their checks on it, because I'm sure they got strings attached to those checks, and not everybody's going to get one of those checks.
No. And look, down here when that Hurricane Irene hit, they were supposed to have given families free food stamps. And this county here wouldn't give them out. They wouldn't give them out. And the other county was giving out the food stamps because my wife's cousin lived in an adjacent county where they were giving out the food stamps, and they said, we don't have any. And the people raised so much stink about it until they had to call Walter B. Jones Jr. at that time when he was living and say, look, people are denying us food stamps around here. Now, it's not to say that some whites didn't get it, but I'm just telling you now that the last thing that black folks need to rely on in any situation is local, state, and federal government, because we know that if we go to the till, I go back to those five wise maidens and those five foolish maidens. See, we ain't never invited to the party. And if we are invited to the party, most of the time they want us to be servants. The only way we're going to get some is the crumbs, because they complain about the crumbs. Now, whenever you hear them talking about social programs, they always talk about how black folks is sopping up all these social programs with the few crumbs that we do get. And white folks are getting the majority of it anyway, but they're complaining about black folks getting it, even if we ain't getting the majority of it. So the last thing that we need to rely on, and we need to stress this, is not to rely on local, state, and federal government. So I get off of that.
I agree. And matter of fact, during this downtime now, because I don't know how long it's going to last, but if you can start a business based on those five pockets, food, shelter,
clothing,
transportation, healthcare, and clothing.
That's right.
You know, anybody who, now this is, we almost at the end of March, anybody who dust off those New Year's resolutions, because you can turn some things around. All right, thank you, Beasley, for that feedback. Let's go to Let's do, hold it, wait a minute. Let's go to the next caller. 314 area code, your mic is open.
What do you say, L.A.?
It's a good day, sunshiny, full of opportunities for those.
Did you listen to that Ghana radio station that had me on the guest
speaking? I didn't get a chance. I'm going to do that today. I found it. Matter of fact, when you told me about it, I went online and found it. And then I warned Houston. And then I warned Houston. I was saying, too.
He texted you that's the station.
Yeah. But I found it when you were talking. When you were talking, I looked it up. But then he sent me a reminder as well.
Give me the link. I want to hear it, too.
We ain't giving you no link. You don't need to be listening to that stuff. You cause trouble. We helped them build that station. We provided equipment and materials. And they finally... It's at Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology. And they got studios set up like Face the Nation and cameras to go out and do interviews. And we provided equipment for that one. And it was another one in Accra. It was a private school. KNUS is a public school. The LIB family raised money. And I went over there to make sure that stuff was going where it's supposed to be. But anyway, that was a good conversation that went down on that level.
They archive those shows?
I don't know. If you might try.
When I go back on the site, I'll research it.
Yeah, you might try to find it, but I don't know. I think we stayed on for about a half hour.
Okay.
But they're doing a pretty good job. But, you know, they was talking about Hubert Harrison. Hubert Harrison was, quote unquote, was a radical in his thinking, but he was, in most cases, right on time. He spoke off a stepladder. In some cases, he paid people a dime, a nickel or a quarter to listen to him. And Du Bois and the NAACP tried to get him. No, it was Booker T. Washington. Tried to get him fired from his post office job.
Hmm. That ain't good. Well, it wasn't good.
And it's that same old jealousy that you see that goes on amongst all ethnic groups, including blacks. I mean, that's human nature. When they see you doing something, that's going to infringe in on what they're doing or trying to do, they try to eliminate you and cause you problems. And you always got organizations and spokespersons that try to be the sole progenitor of black folks in America. And
you know, it the piggyback on what you're saying right now on the Netflix miniseries Self-Made, which is based on the life of Madam C.J. Walker, there is a scene. Matter of fact, there's a back and forth rivalry throughout the series where Addie Malone, which is based on the real life character of Annie Malone, her and Madam C.J. Walker going back, you know, they have a rivalry. But then there was another scene where Madam C.J. Walker wanted Booker T. Washington to endorse her company. So she went up on the stage basically without permission, promoted. Then after she made her pitch and got applause. Booker T. Washington pulled her. You know, they went back behind the stage, the curtain or whatever. And Booker T. Washington was not – but once again, this is based on – this is the dramatic license that this particular miniseries took. But it ties into what you're saying. That,
well, you know, you got to look at who these people and what they make – general makeup is, too. I always said, that's the mulattoes that do that damn stuff. Booker T. Washington was a mulatto. Du Bois was a mulatto. And there was quite a few of them that found themselves in those roles. What's that lady that went out there in San Francisco? We was talking about her.
Talking about Mary Pleasant?
Yeah, Mary Pleasant was not an African-American. She was more white. As a matter of fact, I'm saying she was white. She just had a tinge to her because they commented on how she would use white female bathrooms. Nothing was said about it. And there's quite a few of them down there. What's the other lady that said, "God wash my heart, was clean as snow"? I can't think of her name. But it was a lot of them that made their way in prominence, and seemingly they wanted to have carte blanche over the lives of black people. I mean, heck, look at the slaveholders in New Orleans. 28% of the free blacks were slaveholders, and they were generally the mulattoes, especially the women. I mean, that's just the way things happen. But when you look at
Self-Made on Netflix, that's the way they portrayed Annie Malone. Although in real, they portrayed her as mulatto in the Netflix thing, but in real life, both her parents.
She wasn't. Yeah, she wasn't no mulatto. Annie Malone was.
No, she wasn't no mulatto.
Now I tell you what they portrayed also on that lady that was working for NASA. And I can't think of her name. Elizabeth something. Elizabeth Johnson, I think it was. That lady was not African American. That done the calculations on the space probe that went to the moon. So, and they portrayed her with a dark complexion. A black woman. I think it's the same woman that played Madam C.J. Walker. The same actress, if I'm not sure. You're
talking about Olivia Spencer?
Olivia Spencer that was working for NASA? She wasn't.
Olivia Spencer portrayed Madam C.J. Walker.
All right, so who portrayed that lady that worked with NASA that just died?
Oh.
I can't.
I know you're talking about, she's on that TV show, Empire. That's, Taraji P. Henson.
All right. And the lady that she played, do you remember her name? Her first name was Elizabeth something, wasn't it?
I had to look that up. I know what you're talking about because I think I saw that, I saw that movie last.
Well, that lady that actually worked for NASA was not no dark complexion person. Matter of fact, I don't think she was African American. She was light, bright, damn near white. But it don't make no difference. She done what she had to do. But I'm just talking about how people play roles. We could accuse whites of whitewashing, blacks blackwash, whitewash, and blackwash too. Asians characters get whitewashed. That's just human nature. It's the way people do.
Yeah, speaking of which, are you familiar? I'm probably sure you are. According to the late John H. Johnson, he was a de facto black president during his time. Walter Washington. Hold it up. Walter White, who... white skin, blue eyes, blonde hair, but identified as a black person.
I'm not familiar with him. No, sir.
Beasley, you familiar with him?
Yes, I'm familiar with him. In fact, he used to infiltrate white organizations in the Klan and find out what they were doing and report back to the NAACP. He was so white.
Exactly. That's the Walter White I'm talking about. And I've seen pictures of him, but he identified as, I guess he was light bright, what we would call light bright and damn near white. But he did that. He did infiltrate, and then brought the information back.
Yeah, so, we know those things happened back in those days. The thing is that I like to always push is that we got to move forward. You got to move these young people forward. Get these young people educated and skilled, and what's in high demand, and stop settling. A lot of black people just settle. They settle for the least. And that's the difficult thing to do with the young people because the parents don't have that acclimation, don't have that drive, don't have that foresight. Too many of them don't. A lot of them do. I think those that do need to be supported to the umpteenth degree.
There's a lot of work to be done. Any speculation or guesstimates on how long you think this so-called crisis will last in the USA? Because I think
I think it'll stop when it peaks out, when it plateaus, and new cases stop coming on board. I think that when the military and Donald Trump and them decided to put these field hospitals in these metropolitan areas are nearby, that's a good thing. And basically when you are told that you have this virus, then you need to go home and stay home for about 14 days. And you have the flu, unless you have some complications from some underlying condition that you previously have, which will happen. A funny thing, they say a lot of these young kids, these kindergarten kids that got the virus, I guess it's not bothering them, but them kids, they always have them germs on them. You ever walk into a classroom, a kindergarten, first graders, second graders, as soon as you step in that door, it seems like you can feel stuff jumping on you. And they just some little boogers, man. They just carry that stuff. They need to be sprayed down. And they tough, too. But anyway, L.A., you should be well on your way toward accomplishing your tent home. You got a lot of designs there.
As a matter of fact, after I get off this podcast, I need to check with check with a couple people on that as well.
What are you planning on setting up? What kind of climate?
For me personally, right here in Florida, tropical climate. But I'm looking forward to, I need to start planning towards winter, where you need a whole, different type of fabric set up and all that other stuff. So, person can be nice and warm and comfy inside the tent during the winter months. March now, well, it's almost April. This month is basically over with. So before you know it, wintertime will be back.
All right, L.A., I'm going to let you have the rest of the day, man. Get a chance to listen to that interview.
All right, from the station. Okay, let's see. Beasley, anything else you want to contribute for today?
I just wanted to know how I could listen to Brother Pianchi's interview. I never did find out how I could access it.
What I'll do is, because I got a new phone number, I got three new phone, actually four new phone numbers. What I'll do is I'll text later today with the radio station.
Yeah, I'd like to listen to what he has to say. And, you know, I heard inklings of this project that they were working on. And it's nice to see it come to fruition. But I want to end on this note, Brother L.A. I believe, well, you know, I'm suspicious of this coronavirus and what it's creating here, because there's a lot of legislation going behind the scenes that's really going to restrict people's movement. But the thing is, now's the time for black folks to look at this and come up with an infrastructure for survival. And I hope that we can use this as a motivation to do so. And I'll let you leave on that note.
Okay, well, we'll pick back up this, because there's always news around the clock on this virus thing. But Trump wishes, or hopes rather, that everything will be cleared up by Easter weekend. So that's next month, I believe. So that's not long. But I'm looking at this as downtime. And like I say, China is, I don't know if they're letting people in and out of the borders of the country yet, but as far as daily life, they're back to usual over there. Factory workers going to work, going shopping, all that. So, and I think they were 2 months ahead of us. So I figure, IRS extended filing from April 15th to July 15th. And then I think HUD has put a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures for 60 days. Now, I don't know when that clock started running. But I figure by the 4th of July, I think probably things will be all back to normal at the latest. You know, I'm just speculating.
Yeah. So. In fact, they said that high humidity and high temperatures usually does away with most of it. So I'm with you on that. But Brother L.A., you know, I've been listening to some other guys, and what you see is you see white folks struggling for power here. You see the globalists, which is controlled by the money people, trying to enact some things, and Trump, that represents the nationalist, is resisting some things, and it's a power struggle. That's why I'm suspicious of the whole thing. But anyway, I'm a conspiracy theorist.
Absolutely.
Anyway,
politicians do take situations like this, or circumstances like these days, and try to politicize it. In any event, Brother Beasley, thanks. I'll text you that station information. Give me about, in less than an hour, I'll get it to you, because I got to switch phones for that. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.